Campus FM presents a talk organized by the CERN entitled Gaudium et Spes, Your City is Our City, by Reverend Frank McHugh.
Right Reverend Monsignor Ramona, Honorable Minister, ladies and gentlemen, I think it is most appropriate that on this occasion of this year's Gaudium et Spes, I should, in the name of all the members of the Board of Directors of the CERN, of all you here present, and myself personally, to give a very warm welcome to the Archbishop-elect, the Right Reverend Monsignor Paul Cremona, who is honoring us with his presence, and to wish him God's help and a great Admultos Annos. Dear Archbishop, please be assured of our strong support and collaboration, both in prayers and in action. I'm going to open with a quote. The idea that money makes the world go round, as the Master of Ceremonies says in the musical Gabaret, is an old one, yet remarkably resilient. These are really the opening words of the book by Neil Ferguson, published in 2001, with the title Cash Nexus, and a very indicative subtitle, Money and Power in the Modern World, 1700-2000. The ambivalence of money is recorded even in the revealed books. In the book of Ecclesiastes, we read that money answereth all things. While in Paul's letter to Timothy, the love of money is denounced as the root of all evil. On a more romantic note, the crux of Wagner's The Ring of the Nibelung is the curse of Alberich on the ring which the gods stole from him. Alberich blasts the curse on whoever possesses it. He shall be consumed with care, and whoever has it not be gnawed with envy. It would be an understatement to say that for many people the workings of the financial world have no close affinity with ethics. In practice, they are often considered to be mutually exclusive. The philosopher Alistair MacIntyre's rereading of Aristotle is extremely skeptical that the modern business manager can in any way practice a life of virtue. MacIntyre uses the image of the businessman to show how our market-dominated economy is far from the possibility of making place for the practice of virtue. On the other hand, John Dobson, in his Finance Ethics, The Rationality of Virtue, though in agreement with most of what MacIntyre says, he tries to find a way of rethinking finance so to make it compatible with a life of virtue. This entails, among other things, the need to convince the financial community to be virtuous, that to be virtuous is also to be rational. Dobson argues that, open quote, as virtue disappears from our cultural milieu, the fetters of material servitude are merely being replaced by those of moral ignorance. The tragedy of contemporary corporate culture is thus the tragedy of King Midas. In creating the means of unlimited acquisition, we have prevented ourselves from acquiring that which we should most desire. End of quote. Within the field of the Catholic social thought, the publication in 1994 of a book written by two French treasury members and entitled Modern Financial Systems and the Ethical Imperatives of Christianity is a book which can be considered a very important move in this area of study. As a matter of fact, this publication has followed a series of meetings between top financiers under the auspices of the Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace. To talk to us on this important theme, on this important area of Catholic thought, we have the honor today, I have the honor to introduce to you the Reverend Father Dr. Frank McHugh, whose intellectual pedigree of read and is an assurance that this lecture will be most ethically and intellectually stimulating. In Father McHugh's intellectual career, there are three major milestones. First, his tutorship and chaplaincy work at Plato College, Oxford. Then his move to the deanship and fellowship, and then consequently director of the von Hugel Institute at St. Edmund's College, Cambridge University. And thirdly, after his retirement, which the Americans would call an age discrimination, his research fellowship at St. Mary's at St. Mary's University in London. I wouldn't like to keep you any longer, so I'd like to ask Father Q to talk to us on thinking ethics while teaching economics. Father McHugh.
Monsignor and ladies and gentlemen, just to point to the bit of a change of title up there, Your City is Our City, I'll explain exactly why I chose that at the end of the lecture, a lecture, as you can see, on morals and the world of money. And you may be interested in the quotation there. In fact, you might think I should stop before I begin. Countless sermons have been preached on the ethics of business and the business person. Most have nothing to do with business and little to do with ethics. I'll try to make it different. This is my first visit to Malta, but over the years I have had very friendly contact with a number of Maltese people. I think partly the Irish and the Maltese, because of their small islands and Catholicism and natural bright disposition, are very friendly people. When I went to Plato College in Oxford, I found that each year two students financed by the government of Malta came to Plato College to study economics and politics, as I myself was doing. And I became very friendly with a number of them. I've seen some of them here since I arrived on Sunday. The common ground for friendship. And then I had other connections with Malta. I was friendly with two opera singers in my time. One was a man called Jose Soteriano, a wonderful baritone who sang opera in London for many years. And then Oreste Kirkop was a friend of mine, and I remember him with great affection. So it's a great pleasure for me to be here, and I want to thank Father Joe for inviting me on this occasion to come and speak to the people in Malta here on the important topic of money. Thank you, Father Joe. I asked him beforehand, how long am I allowed to speak? And he said, 40 minutes, 45 minutes would be good, and 40 minutes would be better. So I take the hint. I think of a story I heard of a priest who preached long and boring sermons on a Sunday and used to annoy his parishioners. But one Sunday, a gentleman in the congregation got so annoyed at the long, boring sermon that he took his prayer book, his missal, and threw it at the parish priest. And it fell short of its target and hit an old lady in the front seat. And she went down stunned. And the young girl beside her bent over to help her up. And the old lady's voice was heard saying, "No, no, dearie, hit me again. I can still hear him." I'm taking no risks. In dealing with matters of ethics and morality in my career, I have found that the Catholic Church, myself included, tended to talk too much or at length on some topics and not to talk on others. To give you an example, when I was first ordained, I was appointed to a team of marriage counselors for people whose weddings and marriages were going through some trouble. And I found in talking to them that there were two sources of tension and stress in marriage. The first was money and sex. Those were the two tensions. And I found myself that money was more troublesome in stressful marriages than sex. But we could talk about sex and marriage, about birth control and abortion and all the other things. But when it came to money, we had very little to say. The church didn't give us much teaching or guidance on the morality or ethics of money. And then the second thing was that I was asked once to give a talk in a parish in the south of England to the Justice and Peace group in that parish. And as I was talking to these people about ethics and money, I was aware of two men down in the very last seat down there. And these two men, with their body language, were indicating to me that they weren't entirely in agreement with what I was saying. And sure enough, when it came to the question time, one of them stood up and he said, "I'm a bank manager." And he said, "I am a very devout Catholic. I never miss Mass. And I have tried to be a good bank manager. I have been fair with my clients. When some were in trouble over debts that he could not pay off, I was indulgent and helped them." He said, "But never once in a sermon did I hear my vocation as a banking manager commended. The only time I ever heard anything said about money was on that Sunday when the text was, 'It is easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven.' I went home then," he said, "feeling rather sad that my vocation in life was not preached about or commended." And then the other man stood up and he said he was an Anglican, a Church of England devout practitioner, and he also was a bank manager. And he said never in his life had he heard a preacher speak of the vocation of money or the positive meaning of money, but that it was always negative. Money is not negative. The truth is, money talks. The truth is, money rules. The truth is, money is the great universal. In his Economic and Philosophical Manuscripts, Karl Marx says that money is of a predatory nature. It stretches out its tentacles to lay hold on all things. And thereby, money has a universal character. And then he says, which creates the omnipotence of money. And then he turns this to the genius of Shakespeare. You can put up the, I'll come back to that in 1 second. The one on Shakespeare there. Keep those other two at the moment. This is what he quotes from Shakespeare. "Gold," says Shakespeare, "gold, yellow, glittering, precious gold, no gods, I am no votarist. Roots, you clear heavens. Thus, much of this will make black, white, foul, fair, wrong, right, base, noble, old, young, coward, valiant. Why, this will lug your priests and servants from your sides, pluck stout men's pillows from below their heads. This yellow slave will knot and break religions, bless the accursed, make the whore leprosy adored, place thieves and give the title and approbation with senators on the bench. This it is that makes the wapen widow wed again." Now there you have Shakespeare talking about the power of money in almost every part of life. Can you go back now just for a second to the one of the priest? Shall I comment on it briefly? That is Father Plater. I mentioned Plater College. Father Plater was the man who founded Plater College. And exactly 97 years ago, this week, he came to Malta. And he came to Malta to found the Catholic Social Guild and to talk about ethics and money and politics and the teaching of the Church, Catholic social teaching. He came to talk about Rerum Novarum, the encyclical of Leo XIII. And there, when he was speaking of Rerum Novarum, he might have explained, as I now explain, that Rerum Novarum means not, as it was translated in English, the condition of the working class. Rerum Novarum, the two words mean about new things, or even better. Leo XIII was a great Latin scholar. It meant about revolutions. And if you read the first three or four paragraphs of Leo XIII's encyclical, he talks about four revolutions. He said, "The first revolution I want to talk about is the Industrial Revolution, which has fastened on the backs of working people a burden little less than slavery. It is immoral, he said. And then he said, I want to talk about the capitalist revolution. The capitalist revolution, the rich are becoming richer and the poor are getting nowhere. Those who own the capital are benefiting and the propertyless workers, as he called them, are getting nothing out of it. That is immoral. He then said, I want to talk about the third revolution. The third revolution is the socialist revolution. Marxist socialism, materialist and godless. That's the one that really worried him. He said, that is a threat to Christianity itself. And then he said, I want to talk about the fourth revolution, the one that has never taken place, the revolution in Catholic moral and theological thinking about politics and economics and money. Now here am I, 97 years after Father Plato, and I want to talk about financial capitalism, I want to talk about money, I want to talk about corporate capitalism, managerial capitalism, I want to talk about the new word, financialization, how money has become so important in the global international markets that it is driving much more than we can ever see or imagine. The capitalist revolution in its financial form is among us now, and unfortunately, the revolution in the wonderful system of Catholic social thought and Catholic social teaching coming from the encyclicals is really not understood or working amongst us. All that is by way of setting what we're talking about. I want to speak now very briefly, and Father Joe has touched on it, on where do we get our teaching on money from? And the first place, clearly, is from the Old Testament. In the Old Testament, the first message is a negative one, as Father Joe said. In the book of Proverbs, it says, do not toil to acquire wealth. Be wise enough to desist. When your eyes light upon it, it is gone. For suddenly it takes to itself wings, flying like the eagle towards heaven. A rather negative attitude. Be suspicious of it and try to desist from earning it. I was struck this morning at Mass by the psalm that was read by the other priest who celebrated with me. He read Psalm 71, in which he said, he shall save the poor when they cry, and the needy who are helpless. He will have pity on the weak and save the lives of the poor. And again in the book of Proverbs, it says, he that makes haste to be rich shall not be innocent. Now that is a rather negative message that comes out at that stage. And oddly enough, when the New Testament came to be written down, it was a negative side of the thing that was stressed in the New Testament. The best place to find it all is in St. Luke's Gospel. In St. Luke's Gospel, I'll give you a little list of his things. For example, the woes to the rich, woe to the rich for, etc., etc., etc. And then he says, riches choke the development of the word of God. And then he says, he has anointed me to bring the good news to the destitute. He uses the Greek word, tsochoi, because it means people who are really down and out. He condemns the church leaders who swallow the property of widows. He gives a warning about those who are careless in the stewardship, in the care of money. He makes an example of the rich young man who's offered the kingdom of God and the friendship of Jesus Christ and who goes away sad because he has a lot of money. And then this puzzling statement at Luke's last one here, he says, give to anyone who asks without hope for anything therefrom. And that's the one text we find quoted for the next eight centuries, actually. Lend without expecting anything back. And it was used to try to stop investment and to oppose usury and all kinds of investment. So the message at that stage is negative. And when the early fathers of the church began to write, they also took a negative attitude to money. Listen to St. Cyprian. The deep and profound darkness of avarice has blinded your carnal heart. You are the captive and slave of money. You are tied to the chains and bonds of avarice. And you, whom Christ has already freed, are bound anew. And he goes on to say, it's like you're driving the people down into the grave in your pursuit of money. And then, of course, there's the famous six sermons of Clement of Alexandria in the 3rd century when the people were becoming Christians and the rich winners were coming with their money, he decided he had to preach sermons on this, and he preached six sermons which have come to be known as Who is the Rich Man Who Shall Be Saved? And there he's constantly warning against the grasping nature of money and the way it enslaves the people. So the negative thing is very strong, and the two bankers that I referred to at the beginning heard a lot of that, and people here who are working in banks or have devoted their life to being bankers will feel a bit uneasy. But wait a moment, there's a positive side to the teaching of the scriptures. The attitude to riches as an important development of God's plan of creation for humankind is well discussed by Elul. Now, I don't mean Emmanuel Elul, who was governor of the Bank of of Malta. I'm referring to his namesake, Elul, Jacques Elul, a Protestant theologian who wrote a book called Money and Wealth. And in that book, he quotes the book of Ecclesiastes. All to whom God gives wealth and possessions, and whom he enables to enjoy them and accept their lot and find enjoyment in their work, this is a gift from God. So the book of Ecclesiastes does strike the positive note. And Elul comments, I think the quotation is there, by and large, there are no bounds of poverty in Judaism as means of achieving a divinely blessed state of affairs. The Jews don't have the attitude to poverty that we have had in the Christian faith. There are no accusing fingers in Judaism pointing at those engaged in normal activities of earning money and material goods. Mainstream Judaism saw a man's material welfare as from heaven, a gift from the deity, and therefore as something not intrinsically bad, but rather to be valued and prized. So there is this positive side to it, and I would say here we have a principle. I mentioned the negative thing about the suspicion of wealth. I mentioned that the only thing that looks like being positive is you must help the poor. I'll come back to that, of course. And now we have a third statement, that wealth and working for the creation of wealth is a gift of God. But the negative attitude survived and dominated the early church's teaching. And the reason is, I think, to some extent, that at that time, as we all know, the people were expecting the end of the world. So material goods were of no importance. And so the preachers and writers and thinkers in theology were emphasizing, we await the coming of God. Don't be wasting your time devoting it to wealth and earning money in the meantime. But what happened was, we lost a very important part of the Old Testament. In the Old Testament, creation and salvation are one act. They are one act of God. What he created, he meant to be saved. Everything he created, he meant to be saved. When he made man creative, and he meant him to be saved. And he meant that what man created should be saved also. And he meant that what we call green product today should be saved, that the world should be saved, the ecosphere should be saved. Everything that God made, he destined for salvation. But somehow in the New Testament, we separated creation and salvation. And we made salvation something that belonged only to you and me, to the human soul. That's what salvation was all about, the salvation of the human soul. And the rest of creation was to serve us. And we didn't think of saving it. If we had thought of the one act of creation and salvation and the theology of them as one, we would not have needed to have philosophers and economists in the 20th and 21st century talking to us about green products and the ecosphere. We would have known from the beginning and insisted from the beginning, all creation belongs to God and we are committed to its salvation. We have the stewardship of creation and the stewardship of wealth and the stewardship of everything to do with money also. Now that, I think, was lost in the New Testament. Not entirely. And even Luke, if I may quote a Father O'Toole writing on Luke's Gospel in America, he says, Luke does not address merely the individual, but the total structure of relations between people in terms of power, rights, and resources, and love of the neighbor. This tells us that only the poor and powerless can accurately evaluate our social and economic situations. So there is a positive dimension to it. But the positive dimension to the creation of wealth was brought out by Pius XI in his 1931 encyclical, Quadragesimo Anno, the 40th anniversary of Rerum Novarum. In that encyclical, which was written at the time of the Wall Street crash, when the question of money was a very serious and worrying one, Pius XI wrote, "The investment of rather large incomes, so that opportunities for gainful employment may abound, provided that this great work is applied to the production of truly useful products, we gather this," he says, "from the study of Thomas Aquinas, is to be considered a noble deed of magnificent virtue, and especially suited to the needs of our times." And the great German theologian and teacher of Catholic social thought, Oswald Nell Breuning, who lived to be over 100, and who advised Pius XI on the encyclical, he wrote, "Pius XI revived the idea of magnificence, not in its feudal form, but rather modernized throughout. The magnificence that Pius XI speaks about is a genuinely capitalistic virtue. The Pope makes it a virtue of the entrepreneur, not in the sense that all present-day employers practice this virtue, but meaning that it is the virtue proper to the capitalist employer." What I'm trying to do here is I'm trying to show the negative side, the distrust of wealth, the need for distribution, just distribution, the need for overcoming poverty, but at the same time the balance to be found in Catholic social thought between that and the positive notion of virtues of the entrepreneur. In fact, in the financial economy, under financialization, we will never deal with the poor unless we find a way of supporting morally, as well as every other way, the kind of system inside which we are now living. That means, of course, ethical and moral control of it and of all its excesses, of which I will speak a little bit more in a moment. So we are picking out a number of principles that come into the discussion of this and money. Now, the next thing I want to do is I want to talk very briefly, since my time, as I've told you, is limited, I want to speak very briefly about usury. Usury was a very big thing in the Catholic Church up until the 18th century. Usury was, at its simplest, making money out of investment. And the Church was bitterly opposed to it because it considered it was the enemy of poor people. And you can see in that interesting medieval picture that I've given you there that there are two men sitting at a table dealing in money, and there's a Franciscan and a Dominican walking away. That was a 12th century thing. It's in the museum in Paris, a 12th century picture of the Church's attitude to usury, that the Jews were lending money, exploiting the people, it was said, and the Dominican and the Franciscan, under the direction of the Church, were walking away. Now, it was condemned. The principle of usury was condemned by the popes consistently from the 8th century until 1745 in the encyclical Vix Pervenit of Benedict XIV. Wealth is created for just distribution and not for personal gain and exploitation. And the Bible was always quoted, the books of Exodus, Deuteronomy, and Leviticus, and Ezekiel, "Lord, who shall dwell in your tabernacle? Who shall live on your holy hill? He that hath not put out his money to usury." Now, to summarize what I wanted to say then, appeared in the text that was on the screen just before I started to speak, Thinking Ethics While Learning Finance. The theologians and thinkers between the 8th and the 17th century dealing with this usury, they began to study their economics very carefully. In fact, Noonan, who wrote the great book on usury, says that the theologians of the Middle Ages were the people who not only founded moral thinking on money under capitalism in those ages. In doing this, while they were thinking ethics, they began to modify their ethics. And so the strict ruled against usury, which was issued by the popes and by all the preachers under condemnation to hell and excommunication in this life, all these thinkers began to modify that teaching in the light of learning, their economics. There's a next one there. Nothing is baser, nothing more cruel, says the preacher, than the interest that comes from lending. Under the mask of kindness, the lender deeper digs the grave of poverty when he stretches out his hand to help and pushes them down. But the theologians began to be unhappy about that. And in Dante's Inferno, when the poet is walking through hell, being led there by Virgil, he becomes very uneasy when he finds the usurers beside all the other great sinners suffering the pains of hell. And he turns round to Virgil and he says, "Once more a little backward turn thee," said I. "There where thou sayest that usury offends goodness divine and disengage the knot." He said, "I'm knotted and puzzled by why you should be so opposed to usury. Untie the knot for me." And so the theologians began to untie the knot. They laid the foundations of economic theory, and they laid the foundations of a much more careful, nuanced, precise theory of ethics and morals and finance that could be applied throughout the system. My next stage, again, if I had time, would be to talk about the real world. In the real world, there are actually two worlds of money. There is the ordinary, visible world and the shadowy, specialized one. In the first, ordinary, visible world, there are solid coins and notes, wages are earned, salaries paid into the banks, out of which they're soon spent, and credit taken out as loans to keep people going till their next salary. And then the other one is the complex, shadowy world of the professional, institutionalized finance and markets. Central bankers, investment bankers, futures dealers, arbitragers, hedge funds, derivatives dealers, private equity investors, bond experts and traders. Now, I only mention those in order to say it's a very, very complex world. And our moral thinking has to be as careful and complex as the world that it is trying to address. That brings us to the need of people like Father Joe here, who has discern, to people with think tanks and research centres, where they can study these things in great detail. One of the big weaknesses is that we do not put enough time and money and energy into making our Catholic, our wonderful Catholic social teaching, as careful and precise and nuanced as it can be made in order to convince people that we have a serious task to do. If I were to go on describing the real world, I'd be talking about the terrible state in most of Europe. Perhaps Malta is not like this, Malta is unusual, but in most of Europe and in America, where the population is very deeply in debt. In England, young people under 25, there's an average £20,000 debt on nearly all young people under 25 years of age. And consumer credit is a dreadful thing. And people like loan sharks and lenders of money are abounding in England, charging up sometimes to an annual percentage rate of 120% for loans, on the doorstep, as they're called. And when the government recently was proposing control of these loan sharks and people on the doorstep lending, the Commission for Competition said, no, we can't kill off competition in the cause of achieving the social impacts that you want. That was only a few weeks ago. So I would want to be describing that how personal wealth, how individuals dealing with money get into all sorts of debts and troubles, and the legislation is not being brought forward. There are interests which are opposing legislation sometimes and regulations in dealing with this. That is a moral matter for us to address. And I'd have even far more difficulty if I had to deal with the institutional sector, where the situation is extraordinary. For instance, to give you one statistic I came across recently. Since 1990, there has been the super rich in Britain have increased their wealth between 500 and 600%. And in the same period, the retail price index has only gone up 60%. And a consequence of this is there are far more poor people than could be imagined. We talk about the super rich and they're relatively poor, but the fact of the matter is that the financial system is such at the moment that the rich are getting super rich, and even if the poor are getting a little bit better off, by comparison, they are not getting the shares. They are in something the same position as regards inequality as Leo XIII complained about when he said the capitalist system is creating inequalities, unacceptable inequalities between the rich and the poor, and that is not good for society. One could go on giving a list of statistics. I just want to make the point that we've got to go, that those of us who are in the teaching of Catholic social thought and working in the church's think tanks have got to get much more deeply into the realities. Otherwise, bankers and financiers just don't take us seriously. Now, having said all that, here again will be the next stage of my argument if I had time. I would now go into economic theory, and I would try to explain that one of the things that stops us, that inhibits morality in business and in finance, is economic theory itself. The more mathematical and econometric economic theory became, the more unethical it became. It had no place for ethics. When the economic theory comes from the old Scottish school of common sense and Adam Smith and even Keynes and others, in those formulations of economic theory, I call economic theory ethics friendly. It leaves a place for social impacts. Now, there you have a kind of model of political economy. You've got competitive economy, directive economy, and communitarian. In communitarian economic theory, there's partnership, cooperation, social groupings, cross-border forums, and you quite easily find a place for ethical formation. What I would want to say there is that there are a number of economic theorists at the moment, a number of them from Scotland, and they are saying the textbooks that we have are damaging the real possible impacts of economics, especially in the area of social impacts and ethics. And if we had a reformulation of economic theory along the line of the common sense economics of Scotland and political theory, you'd find included in the list of its characteristics there would be a place for ethical formation, as you find in the bottom right-hand corner there. So, again, that's an important part of the lecture I'd want to give of how economic theory can be brought into this. I want now to get on quickly to Catholic social thought. I understand Catholic social thought as the system, the theological thinking about social issues, which takes its lead from Catholic social teaching, but also includes, that's Catholic, official Catholic social teaching, the encyclical of the popes. You've always got to have one eye over your shoulder at what the popes have written in this matter in work in developing your moral theory. My argument would be that first of all, there is a Catholic social teaching, and then there's Catholic non-official social thinking, the kind of thing that Father Joe and all those working in his institute and in many others throughout the church, where people are thinking about these problems and consulting the advice of bankers and financiers, etc., etc., and we must take their advice seriously. That kind of non-official social thinking combines with the Catholic social teaching of the encyclicals, and out of that you get a system of Catholic social thought which can face up to any system of moral or ethical thinking. Now, that's not just my idea. I'm told that, when I've read it in one of the books on Leo XIII, that one day his secretary said to him, I'm getting messages from one of the Italian dioceses, and they're suggesting you should write an encyclical on something to do with money. And Leo said, no, no. He said, much too soon. He said, I have to wait till the people have been thinking and troubled and working at it and have their problems clearly stated and some ideas about what it's all about. He said, then I write the encyclical. So Catholic social thought is that kind of thing. And there should be places in colleges and seminaries for much more careful teaching of Catholic social thought in order that it should be developed in this way. As Catholic social thought, I would call it C-A-T-H-S-T, and Catholic social teaching, C-S-T, and C-N-O-S-T, Catholic non-official social teaching. I have done a breakdown of the encyclicals. You'll see on the left-hand column the encyclical Vix per Venit from 1715. It has got very little on social teaching. It's simply a few statements about money from Pope Benedict the 14th, who was a great scholar, incidentally. And then I look at Rerum Novarum. I look at Rerum Novarum, Quadragesimo Anno, Mater et Magistra, Laborum Exercens, and Centesimus Annus. And I look at them from left to right, and I've broken them up into the important concepts and discussions in all of these encyclicals, and related them to each other. And you can go along to the last one, 1991, and you see just how much John Paul II dealt with in this: property, free markets, technology, the legitimate role of profit. He discusses subsidiarity, and he talks about structural sin. Now, what I'd be suggesting is that in a serious teaching of Catholic social thought on money, you would look at all this carefully worked out system of Catholic social thought inspired by the encyclicals, and then you would have an important system of thought that I think would find a place not only in academic circles, but in church life and even in the councils of government and debate. I'd be looking at the next one, please. I'd be looking at the main concepts of Catholic social teaching, the triangle there. I see Catholic social teaching as like a triangle, and at the top there is the concept of solidarity. Solidarity, community, the involvement of the whole people of God in the work of the church. That's what solidarity is. The involvement of the whole people of God in the thinking and action and work and virtue of the church. That is at the top of all Catholic theology, and it's at the top of Catholic social teaching in a specific way as guiding all the rest of the discussion. Underneath, I would see subsidiarity. That means giving authority, a crack of the whip, giving authority at the appropriate level. It doesn't mean bottom up at all. It means top down and bottom up and middle across. At every place, people should be involved where they have authority and position and responsibility and the best thing to say. And over in the right-hand corner, I would put the other virtue, which is justice. Now, justice, I don't just mean making a claim. I mean as much giving as receiving. Distributive justice, I mean the justice that says what you have got to give from your riches, you give to somebody else. That is the full meaning of poverty, of justice. And that Catholic social teaching is solidarity, subsidiarity, and justice, the people of God gathered together, taking responsibility at their own level in every way and driven by conscience to overcome these things. As I say, it's done. Catholic social teaching is worked out by middle-level thinking, which I consider a very important idea. And all I want to say about it now is when I was taught Catholic social thought in Oxford, and Manny Elul would be taught the same thing, I was given the impression that it was rather like a bundle of principles that I had up there from heaven or somewhere from my clever teachers. We always admired our teachers. The Irish poet who wrote The Deserted Village, Oliver Goldsmith, looking at his headmaster, wrote the famous lines, "The more we gazed, the more the wonder grew that one small head could carry all he knew." And that, I think, was true of a lot of us as well. But I had the impression that my small head, or the small head above me that carried so much, had given me the little package, and I could come down like a parachute into the parishes and into the church and open up the packet, and there it would all tumble out and magically work. It's not like that. It's a middle-level thinking. It means you take Rerum Novarum and the encyclicals, you take the thinking, you take solidarity, subsidiarity, and justice, and it's more like an engineer's focused instrument. You go so far and you look at it carefully and you pray about it and work about it, and then the light takes you a bit further and a bit further and a bit further, and you're working your way through, all the way through to the light, through the light of the Catholic teaching and its application. I consider middle-level thinking of that type, as done by Joe and others, is critical. Otherwise, we end up with a society which has, may I quote, come to measure the wrong bottom line. Form over substance, prestige over virtue, money over achievements, charisma over character, the ephemeral over the enduring, even mammon over God. That would be the end result. I want to comment quite briefly on what I said, the title I put up on the board there, Your City or Our City. In Alice in Wonderland, the Duchess makes the remark, the more there is of mine, the less there is of yours. And the Latin word for alone is mutuum, which means meum and tuum, mine and yours. There's always a tension between mine and yours, how much I have and how much you get, and how much we have to give to each other. Now, I was looking at an advert one day in a financial magazine, and it said, it came from the city. When you use the city in England, you mean the financial city. It came from the city, and it says, our city is your city. A kind of magnanimous gesture from the people in the financial city saying, we're here to help you and do good for you. And I thought, really, it should be the other way around. I should be saying to you, your city is our city. You are responsible to us in solidarity and subsidiarity. At the end of the day, there must be some way in which we can achieve transparency. Catholic social teaching is very much for the people of God providing a check and advice and a say and a control and an impact on what comes from every quarter at them. Your city is our city. There's something, I'm not saying the Catholic Church is meant to be democratic. I am saying there is a widespread duty of responsibility for almost everything within the church. That's why I put up, your city is our city. Now, it may seem that we're very critical of business, and one could be more critical. There are strange things going on in the line of fraud and so on. There are very strange things going on. For instance, George Bush, his administration this very week, has issued a warning to three British banks, the Royal Bank of Scotland, the Hong Kong Shanghai Bank, and Barclays. He's issued a very strong warning to them that they must stop acting as intermediaries and agents in promoting investment in Iran. And they are threatening other British banks. Now, I think that needs to be checked upon. He's not consulting. And I have to know that it's the best thing for Iran. But there's quite a lot of those kind of things going on inside the city. I have been positive about it, but I want to say that those are there too. But I also detect from the city a lot of corporate social responsibility talk. There is a great deal of it now. Corporate social responsibility. If you look at the business schools' programs of education, you might not find ethics or Catholic social teaching, but you'll certainly find programs of corporate social responsibility. And it's a good thing. It came from democratic ideas and from stakeholder theory, corporate governments. They have the FSA. I noticed driving through yesterday in Malta, you have an FSA here too, Financial Service Authority, and one in London. And there's a great deal of corporate social responsibility talk coming out of it. And green products and ecosystems and clean energy and all that. Mind you, I'm enough of a skeptic to recognize that many people coming into this, for instance, Richard Branson has guaranteed to put 1.5 billion money over the next 10 years into clean energy. But he didn't say that he has set up a company to manufacture and create clean energy. So I think there's always that kind of thing too. Be suspicious of people's motives as much as you are of mine. So there's a corporate social responsibility lobby, which is very strong in coming out. What I would say about it, there's enough good in it morally for us to be able to dialogue with it and dialogue seriously with it. Their corporate social responsibility is their name for ethics. There are people like John Kenneth Galbraith, recently dead, and Peter Drucker, recently dead, and Milton Friedman, recently dead, and Goshan, the Indian economist, who died very young. The other three were 100, whatever that means about the economists, I don't know. But they have all spoken about the social impacts and the need to get away from mathematical economics and the need to look at the corporation as a new kind of thing and thinking about it, and you would think of ethics in you. So I think there's something coming out of business too that is optimistic and that we should latch on to, and in our courses in business ethics, we should dialogue with them. To finish, I would put down 6 points from Catholic social teaching. I'd be talking first, there's need for more training and competence programs in the financial sector. The financial sector, I've given this a number of copies of this thing. It's produced by the Christian Association of Business Executives in London, and it's about the training and competence of people in the financial sector in corporate social responsibility and indeed in ethics and morality of a Christian nature. That's one thing I think would be good to do. In spite of the fact that the financial system does show many characteristics of interdependence, it suffers from isolation. When you go into the city to talk to people, they're isolated from a great deal of what goes on round about them. They become such specialists, and their time is so precious and taken up that they lose sight of a lot of things in human life and society. And solidarity and subsidiarity teaching would help there. In the interest of transparency, there should be more disclosure to shareholders and to the public. I would always argue, and have argued for years, that there's more need for forums, for groups of people who are brought into the audit and discussion of what's going on in the financial sector. There should be a wider encouragement and understanding of classes, regions, and conditions that exist away from the financial sectors. That's part of it. And lastly, corporate social responsibility, I think, should be encouraged. I want to give a brief quote to finish of James Madison, one of America's founding fathers. If men were angels, no government would be necessary. If angels were to govern men, neither external nor internal controls would be necessary. In framing a government which is to be administered by men over men, the great difficulty lies in this. You must first enable the government to control the governed, and in the next place, oblige it to control itself. Now, that is important. I have had some fascinating tours of churches and matters of Catholic interest in Malta over the past couple of days with Father Joe. This island is a treasure house. I've seen images of spirituality and sainthood down the Christian centuries. I saw Caravaggio's wonderful picture of the beheading of John the Baptist, the saint. I have seen the palms of martyrdom on a number of pictures. I've seen St. Jerome sitting on his bed, translating the Bible into Greek, the Septuagint that was left to us. I've seen saints with the lilies in their hands, the lily of virginity in their hands, and halos around their heads. This is the point of my talk this evening, when all the talking is done. My talk this evening, I like to think, is about sanctity and spirituality. I've seen the sanctity and spirituality of the past, and I admire it, and I love it. I'm a traditionalist in many ways. But for the 21st century, what is the spirituality and sanctity? The image is different. It's the shopper with a trolley asking, can I be a saint in modern life? Our preaching and our teaching should have that kind of thing in mind, that in the business of ordinary life and the ordinary business of living, that we should be able to reach out sanctity in the highly complex and different world in which money, financialization, is driving much of what we do. Thank you very much indeed.
And now we are taking 10 minutes of questions.
Or comments.
Or comments, yeah.
All right. Thank you very much for your enjoyable lecture. I also believe that most of the evil we have in the world is due to the absence of morality in economics rather than in other spheres, which the Church very often doesn't stress enough, I believe. If the Church really feels that morality in the economic life is so intrinsic to our health, not only even from spiritual health and so on, how do you look at the fact that Plato College was closed down? And if the Church feels that such a forum, as you said before, and a possibility to be educated, not only in economics or sciences and so on, but also in the Catholic philosophy of how to apply these disciplines. So I would like to make a suggestion. And Malta is an ideal place to have an international center along these lines. After all, Father Peter, I believe, is buried over here. So we can revive his dream, and which is, I think, quite needs to be woken up a bit, prodded up, and maybe with your influence and your contacts, I'm quite sure you have international contacts, there would be a forum, which, especially with our entry into the European Union, where we can have an influence in real terms, how people who want to do good in their line of work, but yet they don't know how to search for the right formula. I mean, it's a topic you can talk about till the cows come home, but
as a
as a practical person yourself, I think this is a proposal I would like to make. Thank you.
It's a good question, and I think the closure of Plato College is very sad. It became almost inevitable because the place was being very badly managed. Obviously, there was a dereliction of duty by the Board of Governors. Secondly, there was behaviors and practices that were not suitable in a Catholic college, someone had to intervene. And then the government, the Department for Education and Science, did its five-yearly investigation or study of the college and found the standards were so bad that they threatened to close it. And within a short time, it was closed for all these reasons, which is very sad. I spent last Friday in the House of Commons Parliament in London with a small group of people, all Catholics as it happens, who were discussing the Plato College situation. The place has now been sold in Oxford. There was £5.8 million pounds got for it, and people weren't sure what was going to happen to it. There were all sorts of rumours, but some of us pointed out that there was a trust deed from the time of Father Plater specifying what the money should be used for. It should be used for the promotion of leadership and people in Catholic social thought and teaching in the areas of morality concerned with politics, economics, and social studies. So at our meeting last week, we sat down to discuss how are we going to use this money in such a way as to make it, to create some kind of institution that will perpetuate the very things that Plato was going to do. Now, what form it will take, I don't know. It might be in the form of a think tank, with one or two people, but they would have the responsibilities for giving courses and teaching and all the rest of it. A number of Catholic colleges in England, three or four of them, are interested in housing it. One of them is Blackfriars in Oxford. So the thing is under serious discussion at the moment to try and achieve the very things you are saying, and it is being rescued, I think, at the last minute. I'd be very happy if it is rescued. It made a big contribution to Malta, Plato College did. And Malta made a big contribution to Plato College, so I can understand the particular interest here in this matter. I hope you can say a prayer that it will turn out as well as we hope it will. Is that satisfied? Thank you.
I happen to be the chairman of the chairman of APS Bank.
Oh, yes. Thank you. I'm your friend.
Just listen. My shareholder, 85%, is here.
Yes.
The bank belongs to the Archdiocese of Malta and the Diocese of Gozo. It was founded by a contemporary of Father Plater, by another Jesuit. And it's funny, you don't know even about it. And you came to talk about banks and money. It was founded to implement the teaching of the Rerum Novarum way back in early 1900. Its mission now is precisely to implement, as you have been saying, and be an example of how to implement the social teaching of the Catholic Church in the various ramifications. The Church has made a very, very big decision recently to strengthen this bank, to give it a direct mission, to get the bank involved directly in the restructuring of various sectors, move directly in. We have set up a subsidiary. It's called the APS Consult, because our banking classes do not allow us to do this type of work. But we intend to move on sector by sector, education, health, retirement homes for the elderly, in conjunction with other church banks in Europe, mainly in Germany, and with the recently founded FEBEA, which is the European Federation of Ethical and Alternative Financial Institutions. So the fact that we are now members of the European Union, as you put it,
yes,
as members of, we can implement what Father Plater did and encouraged 90 years ago, we intend to put it into practice. At the moment, the bank owns $250 million assets, with about 20 million in capital, 6 million directly injected by the Catholic Church over here. We're working closely with the Catholic Church in Germany, banks in Germany, and Protestant banks in Germany, together with the Banca Etica in Italy, and other French ethical banks, so that eventually, we shall be an instrument, not just in the Europe. In fact, we shall be investing soon to set up other banks in Eastern Europe based on cooperative and mutual banking finance, and eventually also in the Mediterranean region. So the idea that we are located here, but we are a Catholic bank, and therefore we have to collaborate with others in exchange to try to push up the income of everybody, to stimulate economic demand, hopefully, as you put it, to take the positive side of the church eating for the past 2,000 years. Thank you, Father.
Yes. I mean, it has never been more important than at the moment with the European Union and what's going on in world politics and in the financial system. And there are a number of initiatives. There's a new, quite new institute set up at the University of Leuven in Belgium. It's called the Center for Catholic Social Thought. And there's a very good one in St. Thomas's in Minnesota in Germany, again, the Center for Catholic Social Thought. I was involved in the creation of both of them. And a number of others I could mention, the Observatoire de la Finance, which is for ethics in the financial system in Geneva. But my feeling about all of them is that they are not taking Catholic social teaching seriously enough. It's difficult to persuade them about the riches of the thing, even as an intellectual system. And philosophers would agree, and economists and moral theologians. It has got wonderful force, and a great deal of the communitarian movement that exists in the best part of European politics, Germany and France have got particularly good ones. So it is a time, and Malta, you know. I'm amazed that Malta doesn't have more summer schools. And I can imagine Americans falling over themselves to come here for summer schools and study times. And Catholic social thought would certainly be something that is attractive. There are many of them growing up in America now, you know. So maybe Father Joseph will extend the ambit of his work and do even more of this, you know. But thank you for the important reminder. There's somebody down at the very back there. Sorry.
Father, all the time you were talking today to us, I was figuring out the effect of misuse of money, scandalizing misuse of money by nations that are strong. Where do I say this? I've just been reading a book by Jeffrey Sachs, who was the man working shoulder to shoulder with Kofi Annan. And the name of the book is The End of Poverty.
The End of Politics.
End of Poverty. No. Poverty. Poverty.
Poverty. Oh, the end poverty. Of poverty. I know what you mean, yes.
The root of all evil is misuse of money. And he accuses the United States in particular of forking out only a minimal amount, a very small percentage of their gross national product. Less than 0.5%. Why do I say am I feel scandalized? Because according to statistics, 15,000 people per day are dying in Africa for lack of support for medicines by people who can afford it, nations who can afford it. 15,000 people per day. This tragic specter. Now, I was thinking, is there a formula between goodwill and goodwill and effects by use of money. Put some notes here when you're talking. And the formula, I said goodwill and spiritual, what did I say? Satisfaction. Spiritual satisfaction, the way the Catholic Church wants it to be. Can we conceive a formula which will help as a strategy to fight poverty by the proper use of money? Thank you very much. I don't know how much this is relevant to your...
Well, the end of poverty would be a wonderful thing. But, you know, I think in Catholic...
The end of poverty in about 25 years' time with the proper use of money.
Yes. I'll comment on that in a moment. Just one introductory remark. The end of poverty in Catholic social thought and teaching, I want to be a little bit careful, because I would never wish for the end of poverty within the Catholic Church. There's something in the virtue of poverty and voluntary renunciation that will always be necessary for the best health of the human community. But you're asking a much more specific and economic question. Let me give you an example. The end of poverty, there's a great deal of money goes into third world aid. But the recent statistics released show that whereas the GDP, the contribution of the developing countries to GDP productivity worldwide has gone up by about 32% in a very short period. But on the other hand, only 8% of investment into the countries exists. The point I'm making is that as well as thinking about giving alms and giving aid, even on a massive scale, we should be in there, and I've never heard anyone or seen any Christian or Catholic commentator, we should be in there indicating there are things happening in the economy at the moment that need to be pushed and strengthened in order to alleviate poverty within the next 20 years or whatever. And when I say that we should be studying these things more carefully, I think we'd make a much better contribution to the debate on international poverty if we also got into the economics of it. Because, again, one can be a bit optimistic about some of the signs around. I think China and India and some African countries are beginning to change this whole matter of understanding poverty and economics. So I think you're making a good point. And the answer to it is that one thing we can do is concentrate on the economics that are showing some optimism about how it might be solved even faster than it is.
I'm troubled by the fact that the Catholic Church doesn't seem to be taking a strong enough attitude towards promoting the idea that it is totally objectionable and unethical to destroy the environment the way we are doing. Sometimes you read over the internet that perhaps a single priest in the USA has tried to promote the idea even by installing certain solar heaters and solar panels for electricity generation on the church to get the idea that, hey, we have to do something. In Malta, we don't get that idea, and I don't know whether there's something in the pipeline like an encyclical about environmental concerns, but I get the idea that the church isn't yet doing enough. Why?
I think we would all say hear, hear to what you're, the point that you're making. And one of the points I made was that if we took our theology of creation and salvation as one act of God and one act in our existence, we would be, because of our understanding of God's creation, meaning to be saved, salvation, we would be promoting it much more strongly. So one answer to you is that if we perhaps improved our preaching, our worldwide preaching a bit in this form, that at least would be a starting point. But of course, as you say, and quite rightly, it would also be true, as is beginning to happen, from the corporate social responsibility lobby, they are beginning to recommend much more widely the introduction of green products and of ecosystems and solar panels and all the rest of it. I mean, we should be preaching. That is the practical application of the theology of creation and salvation to the whole of nature. I think that's one comment I would make. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Father. I would like to make a short comment about the last question about the environment. I think the Catholic Church is, on an international level, is working hard on this theme, and locally, the Diocesan Commission on the Environment has published a very, very strong document very recently, in recent months, on the environment, which is very, very relevant. It is a pity, as regards our theme today, that we seem to be moving to what has been called here by a lapsus, the death of politics. Our political life is being run by world finance. And so we are moving from the welfare state to the warfare state. I think Father McHugh didn't fail our anticipation. I must thank you, Father, for your very clear and wide-ranging lecture. And I think it will be good for all of us to have a look at the classical economists like Adam Smith's theory of moral sentiments, or more recent contemporary economists like Amartya Sen's capability theory. And perhaps it wouldn't be a mistake for us Catholics to teach the official documents of the Church about social affairs. Thank you, Father McHugh, and thank you all of us for your attendance.
You have just listened to a talk organized by the CERN entitled Gaudium et Spes, Your City is Our City. This talk was delivered by Reverend Frank McHugh.